Everybody says that they're a contrarian investor, right up until it's time to write a check in a downturn. And right now, with multifamily trading at roughly 20% off the peak, the question isn't whether or not there's opportunity. It's how do you buy this dip without blowing yourself up on the wrong sponsor or on the wrong assumptions? Welcome back to the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Bopp, and this is where active and aspiring investors get the real-world playbooks from operators who are out there in the field actually deploying capital today. And in today's show, we're going to be breaking down the following. How a professional funds manager vets sponsors in a market full of uncertainty. Where the real opportunities and landmines are in multifamily right now. And then also how diversification inside of a fund can turn one total loss into a balanced win. Lon, I'm excited to have you here to chat with you here today. But before we dive into the meat and potatoes of it all, maybe if you would just take a moment or two and expand upon your background a little bit. Tell our listeners who you are, who Ironton Capital is, and who you guys are built to serve.
Yeah, my background, I worked in corporate finance for a couple of years, went back to business school. I worked as a strategy consultant for 8 years at Deloitte and then Accenture. And then I've been in real estate full time for a couple of decades. I built a real estate brokerage from scratch, which grew to be the largest independent in Colorado. Built a title company, sold both of those off in December of 21, right before the rates went up, and then launched Ironton Capital in June of 22. I've been investing in real estate for a couple decades as a real estate developer and a landlord, and basically we're just taking the same strategy of what I've been doing for the last couple decades, and we're just doing it at a larger scale. And instead of just having a couple friends and family investing along with me, now I can bring like 100 people at a time to invest along with me. So it's worked out really well. Most of the people that we serve are either really busy professionals. They have a lot of stock and bond investment. They want to have real estate exposure, but they don't want to buy a building. So this is an easy way for them to get that kind of diversified access. Or we have a lot of people who've been active investors for a long time. They've kind of gotten frustrated being an active landlord. They're ready to be passive, but they still want the real estate exposure, and we can solve that problem for them. So that tends to be the two people we serve the most.
2022, launching the company then, kind of a precarious time, right? Right before rates were kind of on their upswing. And so talk to me about that a little bit. I don't know what part of 2022, if rates had already started, you know, trending upwards.
It was June.
Maybe it was prior
to
that.
Yeah, so rates
okay, so right around that time.
And it was like obvious that rates are going to have to go up. Nobody expected they're going to go up as much as they did, as rapidly as they did, but we were certainly stress testing things for like, well, when rates go up, how's that going to work out? So that, you know, wasn't like a blinding, you know, surprise from the market or anything like that.
How'd you trend along with it though? I mean, again, just there was quite a bit of uncertainty that kept creeping into the market and got more concentrated as the months and quarters went on. And so just how did you guys make prudent investment decisions, call it within the first 12 months of you launching the fund?
Well, most of it was all the things you would normally do about stress testing. We think the rents in the market are going to be X. Like, well, will they actually be that? Do we have the proper amount of contingencies on the construction that we're doing? Do we have the right amount of time and some safeguards built into the construction schedule? And then, of course, interest rate testing as well. And then does the sponsor have a lot of experience with this type of project, ideally in this geography? So just like the normal checklist of things that you'd usually go through.
Yeah. Well, did you not find it a little bit more difficult maybe with the vetting of sponsors given that period of time? Because, you know, maybe some of the weak links in the chain of maybe some of their investments hadn't shown themselves yet. And so it was a weird time, right? I mean, it was kind of a, you know, how high are rates going to go? How often are we going to see, you know, rate increases by how much, every time the Fed met? And ultimately, when was it going to stop? How long was this ultimately going to play out before, you know, we'd get some stabilization in the marketplace? So, I know just from our perspective as a sponsor, you know, we're incredibly disciplined. We're very conservative of our investments, but it still creates challenges. There's so much uncertainty. You can run all the stress tests and you can use all the data points that are available at that point in time, but it's very, very difficult, to make what's going to be a decision that's not right today, but also right 2, 3, 4 years down the road.
What I try to tell people is that we've got a better than 90% success rate, but we're by no means 100%. You know, for Fund One, right before COVID, we bought an office building that needed to be repositioned in the office suburb of Houston. And then COVID like wrecked that office building. And like, that was a complete loss. You know, fortunately we had 8 investments in that fund. A couple of them were spectacular. It all blended out just fine. But every fund always ends up having one surprise grand slam that, like, wow, I it looks like I was a genius picking this, and that I can walk through a case study why that isn't the case. And that's actually probably a good discussion point for your audience. You get one that, like, I would have never thought that was going to happen. And then sort of the entire range in between.
Well, I think the, you know, the thing I always say is that one thing I can promise you about a pro forma is it's not going to be right. Right. It's either you're going to exceed expectations or you're not going to meet them. And so it's an interesting topic that you bring up there. I think maybe one that we hit upon. It's probably one that, you know, that's asked, you know, to me quite often. You know, we've been running funds now for about a decade. Prior to that, it was always deal specific, but, you know, kind of the benefits and drawbacks of a fund. And I think there's many more benefits than drawbacks. I mean, to your point that you just mentioned there, what tends to happen is if you've got multiple properties within a fund, you're going to hit a home run, maybe in a grand slam on a couple of them. The other is going to do good. And you might have, you know, a bad apple. There might be one in the batch, but ultimately, you know, it's going to kind of even itself out. Whereas if that individual office that you just referenced there, if that was a deal specific syndication, there's no way out of it. There's no way to dig your way out of the hole. I mean, it's an absolute loss for everybody involved.
That's one of the things that you have to expect with a fund of funds is that our goal isn't to be 100% on all of them. Our goal is to deliver a balanced return across all of it. You know, on like Fund 5, for example, we've got an investment in Tampa, Florida. So you might remember about this time last year, there were back-to-back hurricanes that hit Tampa. So one of those nights I went to bed saying, when I wake up in the morning, there's probably going to be a foot of water in our apartment building. And there was. It was 3% of the portfolio. It just didn't really matter that much. You know, so that was definitely a setback of 18 months on the plan. But we had the right insurance. It was just a bump in the road.
What exactly are you looking for as far as sponsors? I mean, what type of vetting are you doing? What type of track record are you seeking? I think there's been a, and the reason I ask that, I think that this, you know, the fund to fund world is one that if you'd asked someone 7 years ago what a fund to fund is, only maybe an institution, someone with an institutional background would have been able to answer that question. I think that's changed significantly over the years. Lots of folks that had no prior real estate experience have seemingly launched fund to fund offerings and, you know, don't necessarily have a track record behind them and don't know necessarily how to ask the right questions, vet sponsors, right? And just have been more capital allocators than anything else. And so would love to, you know, kind of have your perspective, someone with, you know, quite a bit of expertise and experience in the space, both as an individual owner, operator, business owner, and now on the fund-to-fund side, you know, exactly what kind of checklist do you go through and what are you seeking as far as qualifications from a sponsor to invest with?
That's a great question. So there's three of us on investment committee. We've all got different strengths from the experience that we've got. I think the first is that has the sponsor done this type of project full cycle several times in the past? And then let's talk about some of the projects and the things that you expected to be challenges for the project and kind of what you did for a plan going into it. What ambushes did you get halfway through? Because there's always something, sometimes three or four somethings that pop up on a project. How did you address those? As we think about this current project, you know, are there some of the elements of what we've learned in the past that'll, you know, apply? And then of course we'll be ambushed on this project by something we can't even foresee yet. And we'll just have to deal with that as we go. I want to hear like a really comprehensive story about all that. It's nice if they know the local geography and the planning department and how they like to have the plan submitted so they can get through zoning and entitlements a little faster and not have to like try to figure that out on our dime. We like to look at the budgets and just understand what are the contingencies. You know, some things you can bid pretty firmly in advance and that the odds of being surprised is relatively low. So the contingency can be very small on something like that. On the other hand, like if you're buying like a 1990s vintage multifamily community that hasn't had all the pool maintenance done, that's a snake pit. You don't have any idea what's going to come up on that. I want a gigantic contingency on the pool area repairs because I've just been bit too many times or something like that. So the contingency should be variable depending on the uncertainty with the line item. And it's similarly like the amount of time budgeted in the Gantt chart. Some things are pretty certain. Like if you're going to swap out a roof, there shouldn't be a lot of ambiguity about that. Maybe you peel it back and the decking is bad, so you add a couple of days to replace out some plywood. But there's other projects when you like open up a wall, you might be surprised. Oh my God, who would have thought this was going to be in here? And then, you know, suddenly it's like an extra 6 weeks that you didn't expect. So, we just try to go through at a pretty granular level. Another thing that we really try to understand is the target rents when we're done. So we'll actually fly out on site with the CoStar reports and go visit several of the communities that we're benchmarking against. Like, hey, my daughter's relocated to the area. I was wondering if you could show me around the community. What unit would you recommend for her? And then really try to get a grip on, after we renovate this place, we think it's going to slot not quite as nice as this, a little nicer than that. Are these real world rents? really what we're seeing in the CoStar reports, can we really trust this or not? And that's actually where things break an awful lot, is that the rents are a little bit too optimistic, or else the target rent growth is, you know, I wouldn't forecast a lot of rent growth in this environment in most markets right now. If you get some, that'd just be gravy, but I wouldn't plan on it. There's other things too, but that's like a long answer to a short question. I apologize.
No, I would definitely want to hit on, the CoStar data. You say being a little too optimistic with rent growth projections, what have you. So how do you take the data that's being provided, you know, your own gut check going to visit these properties? Like, where's the middle? Where do you find the middle?
Well, you know, what we want to do is take a look at where the market's at currently, and then get a sense of what is the supply additions going to be in the overall metro. I mean, if you can get more granular to like a sub area, that's fantastic, but sometimes it's hard to do. And then think through what supply-demand balance do we have here. If there's a lot of new supply coming in, we could probably expect there to be a lot more concessions to move inventory, and that's going to like have a negative ripple effect all the way through. That can be fine, but we just need to be really conservative on what rent we think we're going to get and how fast we're going to be able to lease up once the renovations are done. Just want to be really, really conservative about that. If, on the other hand, like all of the growth and capacity is downtown and we're out in a far suburb, you know, additional capacity in that market may not impact us as much. So maybe you don't need to be quite as worried about just like the local competition, like a 3-mile drive radius might be enough.
How about geographically? I mean, what regions are you guys bullish in right now? And maybe let's specifically take multifamily, because that's the example that you've been talking to. And I know that you guys have got some industrial stuff as well as a few other investment opportunities, but multifamily, you being, I think, one of the primary ones that you guys are investing in, correct?
Yes. You know, we're mostly trying to look for places that have got positive job growth driving positive population growth over time, because that tends to be the enabler for just lots of favorable things across all of real estate. And then we want to work in business-friendly environments that are pro-landlord. I live in Colorado part of the year, and there's been at least a dozen pieces of legislation in Colorado over the last 3 years that have been anti-landlord, making it much more difficult to do business. We like to work in a place where, like, if you don't pay the rent, you have to leave. It's just, you know, kind of basic business, and that the orientation state is relatively business focused. Like, they want development. They're not trying to fight it. So there, a lot of the southeastern states really fit that. Arizona is a great match. But interestingly, you know, a lot of the Midwest states are not bad, and they tend to be a little bit more stable. So, you know, Michigan and Ohio can also be great places to look. Not so much California, Illinois, Colorado, New York, Massachusetts. You know, we're looking for a positive business environment primarily.
And are we talking about, you know, Class A, B, C?
Yeah, if we're building something new, it'll probably be something Class A. So it might be targeted at workforce housing at a lower price point won't have like a dog spa. But we'll do some Class A, you know, luxury product as well for new construction. But for the renovation projects, those tend to be like a C+ that we're trying to position to a B+.
Maybe of a recent deal that you vetted, something you said no to. You guys have you brought it into your investment committee. You guys, you know, spent some time on it. You know, from outside looking in, you were excited about it. You know, it seemed to check all the boxes, and the majority of the boxes, at least enough to warrant some additional time spent on it. But ultimately, the decision was to pass. Is there one that comes to mind that you can share some details on? Not names of the opportunity or anything like that, but just as to, you know, what popped up that that really pushed you away from the deal?
Yeah, we looked at one in Arkansas a couple of weeks ago in detail, and actually flew out to go look at the market firsthand. And when we actually saw it, when we saw the buildings we were going to compete with and the building subject, and thought through with the scope of work that we've got for renovations, do we really believe that we're going to be one of the very best after this renovation to compete with this set of competitors and get these rents? And we just couldn't get comfortable that we're going to be able to raise the rents that much. We thought we were still going to be, we'd be able to narrow the gap a lot, but we wouldn't be quite there. It's just better to say no if you're not sure. Like, it should be like the obvious. Like, if you're looking at, you know, B+ properties that are 20 or 30 years old and their last remodel was 15 years ago, if you've got a similar project and you're doing a fresh remodel, you should really look great compared to them. And it shouldn't be difficult for someone saying, I need a 1-bedroom, this is my price band, this is our subject, that's the one I want to be at. It should be like obvious. And if not, we'll find another one where it is obvious. So that's what killed that one most recently.
And what are you seeing as far as opportunities in the marketplace? Are you seeing some distress get flushed out that is creating opportunities for buyers like you and I?
It's a great time to be a buyer. You know, it's frustrating that the pace of capital raising for a five-year commitment is slower right now than it was, say, in 22 or before that. Everyone says they're a contrarian investor until they've got to write a check in a downturn, it seems like. But it's a great time.
Isn't that funny?
You know, nationally, multifamily is off 22% from the cyclical highs. So you're buying kind of like just at pre-COVID prices in most markets. There's a lot of things that make me very bullish about the apartment market long term. So I think it's a great time to be a buyer.
Yeah, why is that? Let's talk about the whole, buying when there's blood in the streets, right? And don't get me wrong, I fell into the same camp. 08, I built quite a big portfolio, lost quite a bit of it, had some challenges in 08, and really should have got back up on the horse right away and started buying the opportunities that existed in 9, 10, and really didn't jump back into buying until like 2012. And don't get me wrong, there was great buying opportunities from 2012. Prior to really 2016, there was still quite a bit of discounts out in the marketplace and some good opportunity that could be had. But it's really, it takes quite a bit of experience and probably decades of it and going through a few cycles to really be able to fully subscribe to the feeling of buying when there's so much uncertainty in the marketplace. Why do you think that's so difficult for folks?
I think it's true for any asset class, whether you're buying platinum futures or, Nvidia or Bitcoin or anything else, buying on a dip is always really stressful. And particularly for real estate, because it's so illiquid that, you've bought into something and now you've made a 5-year commitment on it, as opposed to, if you made a mistake buying Nvidia, you could sell it tomorrow morning and then just move on to the next thing. So I think it's the typical buying at the bottom stress. Am I really at the bottom or not? And then the long-term commitment. What I try to encourage people to think about is that if we're making a well-thought-out buy, it doesn't have to be the bottom. As long as we're not buying something silly over a 5-year period, we're going to do really, really well. Because you can only call the bottom 18 months after the fact. And, it's a really narrow window of time where it's absolutely positively perfect. And if you'd get lucky into that, and we have been, that's great. But I think that's something that your viewers want to think about. So I'll give you an example. In Fund 1, we had one home run project, ended up being a 54% return after all fees to the limited partners. And I'd love to tell you that I'm a genius, and that'd be bullshit. The reality is that we bought it at the best possible time in 2020 in the first quarter during the maximum panic of COVID, and we were able to negotiate really excellent terms with the seller because they had to get out and they were panicked as well, and the financing terms were great. And we exited this thing in April of 22. So that buyer locked in their rates in February or January of 22 when they're at bottom dead center and people were at the absolute lather of the top of the bidding frenzy. We could not have timed this any better. The reality is this should have been a project in the mid 20s and we got a 54 because we absolutely slam dunked the buy, slam dunked the sell. Sometimes it just works like that. Just like I got screwed on that office park in Houston. Between the two, it was exactly an offset. It worked out great. So I would encourage your listeners when they've talked to a prospective sponsor like us and they say, here's my trophy, I'm the best. Take a look at the dates and see if that doesn't explain half of the great result they got.
Yeah. It's a great point. I feel like, part of that's still kind of carrying forward with seller expectations of pricing, right? They've got their mind still set on, maybe a broker conversation they had back in 2021 or 2022 as to, the five folks, the five offers they have unsolicited sitting there ready to buy that property. And I ultimately think that they're still fixated on that number. And maybe, at some point it will come back, right? At some point they'll hit that intersection again, but it could be multiple years before they get it.
Well, I think what will probably precipitate is they've got a refinance event because the lock on their loan comes up in 6 months and the reset on the rate's going to force them to bring a bunch of equity to make sure the debt cover ratio is right. And now they're in a choice. Well, I either need to do a huge capital call or I need to sell and just take what I get. We see an awful lot of that.
What type of considerations do you guys or do your sponsors take into account when looking at the capital stack? Obviously rates are starting to trend back down. How fast that will go, not sure. To what extent, we're not sure. And so what type of loans are they putting in place? Is it more, 3 to 5 year debt, doing longer than that, shorter than that? I mean, what's the typical capital stack look like?
Well, we don't do any buy and hold. We either do value add or new build. So we're either going to be in a construction loan or else for, something that's new, or usually something like a construction loan on a heavy value add. So in either case, it's going to be a floating. And then when the value add or the construction is complete, the ideal situation would be to exit at that time. So we rarely are in something fixed with, you know, like a Fannie 10-year product or something like that. We've had some projects that have matured where the construction's done. It's just not a great time to sell. So we'll get something in place that's assumable. But, you know, a lot of times, like, it's, you know, 35% equity and 65% debt. So it's not overly levered.
I know that before we started recording, we had talked about also a debt fund that you guys have. And I was mistaken by thinking that it was related to real estate. And I know that this is a real estate show, but we'd love to maybe open up a dialogue on your debt fund. It's, you know, it's tied to medical receivables. I didn't know anything about that, and I still don't, even after you give me a brief explanation. So we'd love to maybe chat about that a little bit. Just, you know, maybe share a little bit more with our listeners about exactly what that means, you know, how that debt, you know, the mechanics of the debt fund, how you guys invest in medical receivables, and what that could mean for them.
Yeah. So for me and for our segment of limited partners that are either active landlords transitioning to being a passive investor in real estate, we're really overweighted in real estate and underweight in all the other asset classes, which is a little bit stressful because a lot of the value of our assets is a little bit interest rate sensitive and certainly very exposed to the real estate cycle. So I wanted to try to find something that was not correlated to the stock and bond market and not correlated to interest rates, so I could have something in my portfolio that was just sort of stable. So one of the guys on our investment committee, Richard Landry, found this medical receivable play. So when you see a billboard on the side of the road, if you're in a medical accident, call this attorney and I'll get you justice and a big payment. Those attorneys usually get the calls first. They aggregate all of the leads, and then they've got doctors they work with. Usually they're like, you know, spinal surgeons, whiplash, getting a front end collision. They pick a physician who's good at taking care of the patients and is really good in providing expert testimony to a jury if it comes down to that. So they get all these cases from a small number of attorneys. If it's a large payment that's going to be coming, they'll process and wait 12 or 18 months until the case is settled, and then they'll get their payment. They get a lot of small cases where they're, you know, maybe it's a $30,000 claim or something like that. It's not a lot of medical care. A bigger one might be like $500,000. So it's a headache for them. They've got all this administrative burden. They've got to wait 12 or 18 months before the case is resolved. And they know, is it you with Geico or me with State Farm that's going to be paying this medical bill? So what we have a sponsor that does all of the paperwork, all the administration process, takes that off the burden of the clinic or the doctor. And in addition to that, advances them about 35% of the value of the claim. So if it's a $30,000 medical claim, we write them a check for 10 grand. We take over all the paperwork, and then the doctor is just out of it. They don't have to think about these small little headache claims anymore. So what's great about that is that we've got usually like a basket of about 100 of these with any one doctor, and that's like a group, and they're all cross-collateralized. And we have the expectation that 2 or 3 out of 100 won't work. They're found to be fraudulent. Hey, weren't you like in an accident last week? Or something goes wrong with it, but the other 98 work. So if when one of them breaks, usually it's 2 or 3 that'll break per 100, they're cross-collateralized. We can collect from any one of the other claims in there to get paid back. So the analogy is like if you had 100 rental properties that were all paid off and you came to us as a bank, we'd give you a 35% loan-to-value mortgage across the entire portfolio. And if you default on any one, I could collect against any of the other properties to get paid off. So it reduces the risk quite a bit. We really like that a lot. And then there's dozens and dozens of medical providers across lots of different states, each with their baskets of hundreds of claims. So in composite, it's like a little over 10,000 claims in the overall portfolio. So it's really nicely diversified.
As far as being a potential LP, what are other questions I should be asking you right now to better understand this and understand any of the additional downside of risk associated with it?
Yeah, so it pays between 11 and 13%. So it's a quarterly payment. The more you have invested with us, the higher the rate is. But you'll know what the rate is from day one. It's locked up for a year, and then you can get liquidity on a quarterly notice. So it's got really good liquidity. So that's our most popular product by far. We have a lot of people that, you know, normally they do fix and flips. This is not a good time for that. They're just parking their war chest with us. When the market turns, they'll take the cash out and go. People who are real estate developers want to wait out the storm, same thing. So for a lot of you, you might be uncertain about buying a large commitment real estate parcel, but you need something to do with the money in the interim. This could be a good solution for you.
All good. No, I appreciate that. And guys, we'll make sure we put all that in show notes as well. And, you know, Lon, wrapping things up with more of a, I'd like to kind of end on a macro view. If you could make one prediction or one, you know, one macro level call today that I would judge you on in 24 months from now, what would it be?
So I think for the overall multifamily market, the amount of new construction deliveries has been falling over the last couple of quarters, and it's very likely to keep falling over the next several quarters because the pipeline is really slowing down. So that's not like a big surprise to anybody. I think you're going to see that occupancy is going to be stable or slightly increase, and that the amount of concessions are going to burn off a little bit. It's going to take probably 12 to 18 months to see any material rent growth, but probably around the 18 month out, you'll probably start to see some rent growth as well. After this next 24 months, the next 24 should be fantastic because we will have almost no new supply coming in, and we will have absorbed this gigantic bump of new construction, and then the rent growth should be really, really strong. And what's nice is that when you get those rent growths, almost all that increase drops to the bottom line, so it should really be helpful to NOI and valuation. So that, I think you're going to see stable pricing. I would say that we're at the bottom for pricing for this cycle, and that you're going to see pricing go up from here.
Are there any isolated markets that you're aware of to where that it might not play out in that manner? You know, markets that had quite a bit of oversupply, like Austin and Dallas.
Austin would be your good example. Yeah,
Atlanta and Austin both might take a little bit longer to catch back up and to absorb all the existing product that's there.
Yeah, the way you might want to think about that is if you take a look at the installed base of apartments in a given MSA, look at the new supply that's been added, say, over the last 18 to 24 months, you could rank them from the most amount of growth, and Austin would probably be at the very top of the chart with Atlanta right behind it, to the very bottom, which I think is Cleveland, if I remember right, and there's going to be this continuum. So the slope of the line is going to be more aggressive the lower in the chart you are for the amount of capacity that's been added recently. So you could, you'd want to throw a couple other variables. You want to pick a geography just on that, but that's a very good first screen.
Well, Lon, this has been fantastic. I really appreciate you coming on the show here. Before we wrap it up, is there anything that you'd like to add or anything that we maybe didn't cover today that you would feel would benefit the folks that are tuning in?
I guess the main thing is you could take a look at stock market history or your example with real estate, buying in 2012 and then the amount of appreciation that you had at that. Is that you don't need to be too concerned about timing at the bottom. The main thing is just to get in and try to be diversified across a couple different markets. It is a great time to buy. So if you can just get a little bit comfortable to make that move, I think you're going to be really well rewarded over the next couple of years for buying in a recession.
Awesome. Awesome. No, fantastic. Appreciate that, Lon, and appreciate you for joining me here today. And thank you for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the show today, be sure to take a moment, leave a review, and hit the subscribe button. It really helps us attract great guests like Lon here to the show and deliver more of the content that you guys are tuning in for. So with that, that's all we have for today's show. So until next week's episode, live boundless and be great. Take care.